And by the way, Dave, there is no phallic god in my subterranean lair. Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast.
Which is not your run-of-the-mill archetypal podcast.
Indeed. Well, welcome everyone to episode 14 of the show.
Yeah, Dave, we should begin with a news item. And this news item was sent to us by one of our listeners before our last show. And it turns out that a few weeks ago, Jordan Peterson had checked into rehab.
Yeah, that's right. As I understand, Jordan Peterson's wife, Tammy, was diagnosed with terminal cancer and she had to have her kidney removed.
Oh, my.
And during the surgery, her lymph node was damaged and this led to a lot of complications. Apparently, she was at death's door multiple times.
Yeah, I have a clip here, Dave, from Peterson's daughter who released the news on a video on YouTube. Listen to this.
Mm-hmm. Nobody knew what was going on. She almost died a number of times. Our family doctor put Dad on antidepressants and an anti-anxiety medication called clonazepam so Dad could tolerate the stress, which would have been even harder on him than it was on us, and I found it intolerable. We didn't think much of it at the time.
Yeah, so evidently Jordan was having a hard time dealing with his wife's health problems, which were quite severe, to be fair. And so he was on antidepressants and an anxiolytic sedative, which is used to reduce anxiety, called clonazepam.
Yeah, Dave, you know me. I'm pretty high anxious. Maybe I should take some clonazepam, but actually maybe not. Listen to this.
Mom was flown to the States and they miraculously healed her lymph leak. And when Dad got back, he tried to get off the medications he was prescribed. Turns out clonazepam is hell to get off of.
Uh-oh.
I had taken lorazepam for about 1.5 years when I was 20 to help with sleeping and hadn't had an issue getting off of it. Didn't realize clonazepam is an entirely different monster. So he stopped cold turkey in the summer after talking with a psychiatrist and experienced horrific physical withdrawal and anxiety. Turns out this is more than common with clonazepam. Did you know they put suicide warnings on the bottle in the States? Would have been nice to know prior to the prescription. The reason we're in New York is because Dad's in rehab using other medications to try and get off of this clonazepam. They use shorter acting benzodiazepines to help wean off the clonazepam, which is a very long acting benzodiazepine. So let this be a warning to people. Be very wary of clonazepam. It's not just an anti-anxiety medication. It's very, very difficult to get off of without experiencing physical withdrawal if you take it for more than 6 weeks, say. I've never seen my dad like this. He's having a miserable time of it. It breaks my heart.
Yeah, so he quit the drug cold turkey. And when you come off drugs like that, you go into withdrawal, and the withdrawal symptoms are typically the opposite of the effects of the drug. So if the drug is meant to reduce anxiety, when you stop taking the drug, especially if you stopped abruptly, you can experience more anxiety than you did before. It's very important that people go off these psychoactive drugs very slowly or to try to avoid them altogether.
Yeah, I think we need to do a whole episode on these psychoactive drugs. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get your perspective on it because, I mean, from my perspective, you should, just really use these drugs with extreme caution or just try to avoid them altogether.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that would be a fun episode to do, an important one.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to kick Jordan Peterson while he's down, and we certainly wish him a swift recovery. But in this episode, we want to continue our deconstruction of his worldview, and particularly we want to discuss how deeply he is influenced by the psychoanalyst Carl Jung.
Yes. Now, recall from the last episode that Peterson felt that amongst the most intelligent writers out there were Jung and Nietzsche.
I'm not sure I've ever read anyone as intelligent as Jung, except maybe Nietzsche.
Yeah, and in the last episode, we covered some of Nietzsche's views, his vigorous anti-Christian views, his mm-hmm. critique of Christianity, which Peterson echoed, his distinction between the weak and the strong, whereby the weak are bad and the strong are good, and his vociferous praise of the survival of the fittest as the key principle of cultural salvation.
Yes, Dave, and as you said, today we want to transition from Nietzsche and talk about Carl Jung, but let's take a moment to follow the link between the two characters, at least the link as it appears in Peterson's mind. And so to do that, let's say a few more words about Nietzsche. What Nietzsche was concerned about was that European society was in danger of losing its greatness and falling into nihilism. And for our younger listeners, nihilism is the view that nothing has any meaning, that life is completely meaningless. And Nietzsche's concern about nihilism is directly related to his famous statement, God is dead. I'm sure most of our listeners remember or recognize that term from Nietzsche or that statement from Nietzsche. And I have a clip here from the philosopher Simon Critchley putting Nietzsche's statement into the context of his concern about nihilism.
Nietzsche describes a madman who runs into a public square shouting, God is dead, God is dead. And the people don't believe him, and he's laughed at, and he leaves. He came too soon, he says. I came too soon. But the thought here is deeper and more interesting. It's not that the Nietzsche said God is dead, something you can find on toilet walls the world over. It's that God is dead, we have killed him. And what Nietzsche means by that, I think, is that the outcome of history is the death of God. We no longer need, or we no longer can believe in those sorts of assurances which theology gave us. Through the development of science and technology, we've got ourselves to a position where God is an accessory that we can do without. So it's not that Nietzsche is, as it were, celebrating the death of God. Right? He thinks that God is a pretty bad idea. It makes us cringing, cowardly, submissive creatures. But it doesn't mean that the opposite is something to be celebrated. We shouldn't just celebrate that would lead to sort of nihilism. What Nietzsche's thought is that, human history has led to a point where we find the idea of God incredible. We can no longer believe it. And at that point, he says, there's a risk of us throwing up our hands and saying, well, nothing means anything. And that's what Nietzsche calls nihilism. Nietzsche's thought is not nihilistic. This is a key thing. Nietzsche is trying to think a counter-movement to nihilism, and this is what he calls a revaluation of values, or an overcoming of nihilism. So what Nietzsche wants us to do, Nietzsche wants us to reject our usual ways of thinking morally in terms of a new way of conceiving of value that would be in terms of life, ultimately, and the affirmation of life.
So Nietzsche argued, if you recall from the last episode, that the focus on truth brought in by Christianity ultimately undermined belief in God. That's the killing of God he refers to. And of course, together with that, the bringing in of science and so on. And he argued that without a solid framework of religious belief to ground us, people would be unmoored and prone to nihilism. Lacking a value system with a hierarchy of values, people would be unable to set useful priorities to guide their actions.
Yeah, Dan, I just want to take a little bit of an issue with that. I mean, Peterson also advances this idea that Nietzsche kind of woefully prophesied nihilism and that it didn't celebrate. I think, you know what, he more like midwifed it. He was quite happy to advance the attack on Christianity and to deal this death blow, as Peterson put it, right?
Yes.
And on the other hand, he could have easily defended apologetically, as many have successfully, the idea of Christianity, which we don't have time to get into, but this woeful prophet approach is nothing but a rhetorical tool. It's the same approach that Darwin took in The Origin of Species, and it's a complete sham. Simon Critchley notwithstanding, Nietzsche knew what he was doing, and he was quite happy to do it.
That's right. He was the midwife. I have a clip here, Dave, from Peterson talking about Nietzsche's concern about nihilism and Nietzsche's solution to the problem of nihilism.
And Nietzsche's analysis was predicated on the idea that if the value hierarchy collapsed, well, not only would people not be motivated to do anything anymore, but they would also be extraordinarily confused and depressed, because the value would go out of their life. And the consequence of that would be that they would become somewhat nihilistic, or maybe absolutely nihilistic, or that they would turn to ideological, rigid ideological systems as a replacement. Now, what Nietzsche offered as an alternative to that was that human beings could create their own values. And so his idea was that the superman, the overman, depending on how you look at it, would be the person who was capable of transcending the valueless universe that the decline of religion had left with us and creating their own values as a conscious act. The problem with that is that it isn't obvious that you can create your own values as a conscious act, because it's not obvious that values are consciously created. And I think this is why the psychoanalysts had so much to add to the philosophical debate.
So Peterson says that Nietzsche's solution was that people ought to and could create meaning by just consciously making it up. You just think about it, you make up some goal, make it meaningful, and you proceed towards that goal. But Peterson points out that making meaning might not be a conscious act. And that's when he brings in the depth psychologists as improving upon Nietzsche. Okay, so what are the depth? Who are the depth psychologists? Okay, by depth psychologists, he's referring to people like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, who believe that there are motivations in a person that are unconscious, and there's information that is unconscious, and that through various techniques of analysis, including dream analysis, the unconscious content can be consciously accessed and understood. So critically, Peterson argues, as far as I can tell, that rather than creating meaning consciously, as Nietzsche suggested, you can access deep meaning that's locked away in the unconscious, which is a suggestion that was put forth by one of the key depth psychologists, Carl Jung. And Peterson believes that the depth psychologist Carl Jung made the most significant inroads into understanding how the unconscious works and how to access and characterize the knowledge that we all have in our unconscious. In fact, Peterson believes that Jung made the most important contribution to thought in general, in the 20th century. Here's Peterson speaking on Jung's contribution to overall thought.
And it's conceivable, I think perhaps probable, that nothing more important conceptually happened in the 20th century than that. Because it was the first time post-Enlightenment that a rapprochement between the intellect and the underlying religious archetypal substructure occurred. You have in the capacious intellect of Jung, and the same thing happened to some degree with Piaget, the religious domain and the factual domain were brought back together. And the fact of Jung's enduring and increasing popularity and influence, I would say, is a direct consequence of that.
Woohoo! So Jung, he just made the most important contribution to thought in the 20th century, Dave. And according to Peterson, Jung was so important partly because he created a bridge between religion and scientific psychology.
Right. Well, we'll have to get into that at some point. Mm-hmm. He just keeps praising Jung in his Bible lectures up and down. Here's another clip that illustrates that.
This is one of the things I really liked about Carl Jung. You know, Jung was so radical a thinker. It's just beyond belief. Like, I've read a lot of critics of Jung, and I've always got a kick out of them, because the things they accuse Jung of are so trivial compared to the things that Jung actually did that it's like accusing a murderer of jaywalking. Like, because Jung was unbelievably radical.
Unbelievably radical. And just to finish off this opening segment, Dave, we should share this clip. This is a 2.5-minute clip from Peterson's Bible lecture on Genesis, where he directly and explicitly charts how he links Nietzsche to Jung and then Jung to his interpretation of the Bible, and how he also mixes in a little bit of evolution. Now, some of this will be a little redundant with the prior clips that we just played, but hey, a little repetition is probably good. Listen to this.
Nietzsche's idea was that human beings were going to have to create their own values, essentially. Now, he understood that we had bodies and that we had motivations and emotions, like he was a romantic thinker in some sense, but way ahead of his time, because he knew that our capacity to think wasn't some free-floating soul, but was embedded in our physiology, constrained by our emotions, shaped by our motivation, shaped by our body. He understood that, but he still believed that the only possible way out of the problem would be for human beings themselves to become something akin to God and to create their own values. That was that, and he thought that the person, he
talked about the person who could create their own values as the overman or the superman, and that was one of the parts of Nietzschean philosophy that the Nazis, I would say, took out of context and used to fuel their, you know, superior man.
Yeah, Dave, I just wanted to pause it there. Notice that he says the Nazis took Nietzsche out of context. Because it seems to me that that's a complete whitewash, because if anything, the Nazis followed Nietzsche's suggestions quite accurately.
Watch out for the fresh paint covering up the dark stain whitewash.
Yeah, Dan, that's why, you know, as Benjamin Weicker argues, it's important for people to actually read these old works, because if you don't know what Nietzsche actually wrote, then you would just naively believe what Peterson said about him.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. In fact, in 12 Rules, Peterson makes a similar mistake about Hitler. He claims that Hitler used that big lie technique when it was actually Hitler who criticized the Brits for using the big lie technique.
Dave, what's the big lie technique? Maybe our young listeners wouldn't know.
It's this idea that you just tell, if you tell a big enough lie that's just so overtly big that people can't even conceptualize that you could lie to such a huge extent. They'll just accept it because it's beyond their imagination.
Yeah, that's a good point.
See, there's a good book written by Vox Dei, and he criticizes Peterson's agenda and his 12 rules, and it's titled Jordanetics, A Journey into the Mind of Humanity's Greatest Thinker. That's obviously sarcastic, right?
Oh,
and he makes the point that what happens is, Peterson wanders into so many disciplines that it's difficult for any one person to be able to assess the truth or the accuracy of his claims and his conclusions. Right. Mm-hmm. And then he writes this. He says, well, Peterson speaks and writes with smug assurance and pseudo erudition about everything from evolutionary biology and Christian theology to the works of Friedrich Nietzsche and Carl Jung. But the biologists recognize that he knows nothing about evolution. Theologians can hardly miss his ignorance of Christian theology. The Nietzsche experts recognize that he doesn't understand Nietzsche's philosophy, and the Jung experts are well aware that he doesn't get Jung right either. that's Vox Dei's analysis. But this is a problem of this kind of, speaking in this wide range of everything. And then as an audience, as a listener, as a reader, you don't necessarily have real knowledge in these areas, and you might just easily be bamboozled.
Yeah, and it's important to note that when you read the original material, the original writings, you do sometimes find them to be quite complex and sometimes even unclear and incoherent. And so it's easy to come up with multiple different interpretations. But nevertheless, that's why it's really important to listen to our Deconstruction, the Not Conform show, because you have direct access to quotes. We quote from the books and you might learn a little bit more about these primary sources.
Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So here, let's continue with that clip when we were making the link between Nietzsche and Jung, and then Jung and Jordan Peterson's interpretation of the Bible. Here we continue that clip.
So, and we know what happened with that. That didn't seem to turn out very well. That's for sure.
Yeah, that was the Nazis. And,
see, I also spent a lot of time reading Carl Jung, and it was through Jung and also Jean Piaget, who's a developmental psychologist, that I started to understand that our articulated systems of thought are embedded in something like a dream, and that dream is informed in a complex way by the way we act. So, you know, we act out things we don't understand all the time. And if that wasn't the case, then we wouldn't need a psychology or a sociology or an anthropology or any of that, because we would be completely transparent to ourselves. And we're clearly not. So we're much more complicated than we understand, which means that the way that we behave contains way more information than we know. And part of the dream that surrounds our articulated knowledge has been extracted as a consequence of us watching each other behave and telling stories about it for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, extracting out patterns of behavior that characterize humanity and trying to represent them partly through imitation, but also through drama and mythology and literature and art and all of that, to represent what we're like so that we can understand what we're like. And that process of understanding is what I see unfolding, at least in part, in the biblical stories. And it's halting and partial and awkward and contradictory and all of that, which is one of the things that makes the book so complex. But I see in it the struggle of humanity to arise to rise above its animal forebears, say, and to become conscious of what it means to be human.
Yeah, this clip nicely illustrates Peterson's approach to biblical interpretation, but we'll have to get to that later. I think looking at your Jung outline here, Dan, I don't think we can get to that till next episode. But why don't you tell us a little bit about Carl Jung and his main ideas so that we can fully appreciate this view these views that inspired Peterson?
Yeah, okay, well, let's get into Carl Gustav Jung, as his full name goes. He was a Swiss psychiatrist and psychoanalyst who was born in the late 1800s and then died, I think, in 1961. And Dave, you'll find this very interesting. Jung's father was a Lutheran pastor.
Oh, no, not again. What are the details on that? Do you know any details?
Well, I don't recall much of the details, but I gather that Jung's father came from a prominent family in his town, and he married a woman, which was Jung's mother, obviously, from another prominent family, and he needed a profession, and so he chose to become a preacher. And as history has it, at least from what we learned from Jung's autobiography, later in life, his father starts to struggle with his faith.
Okay.
And it's not clear whether actually he kind of maintained his faith throughout his entire life.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. But by then, a good chunk of Lutheranism had also become liberal, as liberal as the negative afterlife, as one of my professors used to say. So
that's
might
true.
Have been part of the problem. But I don't know. Maybe it's the unholy spirit working extra hard to counteract the benefit that the Holy Spirit worked through Luther in the church. And so now these Lutheran pastors are under special attack. I don't know. It's not a good thing.
Well, I think what we're going to see later on is that actually during that time, paganism was starting to make a resurgence. And so a lot of these guys start getting caught up in that. But we'll leave that for later. But Jung was a student, and I think this is probably something that most people know. He was a student of a well-known psychiatrist, Sigmund Freud. Jung later separated from Freud and developed his own ideas that were in some way quite different from Freud's. And during his lifetime, Jung produced many works. In fact, there are 20 volumes and roughly 10 additional works in one collection called the Bollingen series. And like Freud, Jung distinguished between conscious thoughts, the components of our thoughts of which we are aware, and unconscious mentation, the contents of our psyche of which we are unaware, but which nevertheless influence our attitudes and behaviors. And also like Freud, Jung believed that a key tool for uncovering the contents of the unconscious was the analysis of dreams, because dreams, he believed, included the impressions the unconscious made into consciousness. But Jung's interpretation of dreams differed from that of Freud, and Peterson describes one difference in this clip.
One of the things that Freud did when he was interpreting dreams, and this is quite useful, you know, so if someone comes to me with a dream, then I have them tell me the whole dream, and then I get them to repeat it line by line, and then whenever they say a line and it, there's an object in it or a person or something like that, I ask them what that makes them remember or what that thing means to them or what comes to mind. And that's the associational technique, and it's predicated on the idea that your memory works by association. And you know that if you're daydreaming, you know, you go from one thing to another like a conversation does, and that you can take an idea that's at the center of a web of associations, and by tracking the associations, you can kind of zero in on what the idea might mean. And then Jung expanded that by trying to, he called it to amplify the dream by thinking about narrative or literary or mythological similarities that might be associated with the narrative structure of the dream. And I think often that can be unbelievably useful, you know.
So Jung's idea was to take the contents of someone's dreams and then link them to mythology. And notice Peterson says, hey, this is a great idea. That's very useful. And we'll get back to that point a little bit later. But aside from dreams, Jung believed he could make contact with the contents of his unconscious by allowing himself to experience deep and focused fantasies. And I'm using air quotes here. And that's the term that Jordan Peterson uses. We can also say visions. And I think that's the term that Jung used. And here's how Peterson describes it in his lecture on Jung.
So, Jung, he was a strange guy in many ways. Extraordinarily imaginative. He could get lost in daydreams and was a tremendously powerful visualizer. And a lot of what he discovered was a consequence of engaging in
long-term elaborated fantasies. And in these fantasies, he could have conversations with figures of his imagination and communicate with them.
So Jung is having conversations with entities he's encountering in his deep fantasies, Dave. Mm-hmm. I think we have to come back to that because we're going to have more to say about that.
Yeah.
Now, Jung believed that what came from his dreams and visions were a series of themes or personality structures that he called archetypes. And he argued that the archetypes are present as typical characters and themes in literature and in mythology. This next clip is of Jordan Peterson talking about Jung's concept of the archetype, and that's a very central concept.
Now, human beings are quite peculiar creatures because not only do we act, we also watch ourselves act, and we represent those actions. And Jung believed that as a consequence of us manifesting a specific set of typically human behaviors over hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of years, we also evolved a cognitive apparatus that was capable of representing those patterns of behavior. And that cognitive apparatus expressed the representations of those fundamental patterns of behavior in imagistic and symbolic form. And the basic imagistic and symbolic form is something like drama. Now, why would that be? Well, it's obvious in some sense. What is drama? Drama is the representation, the abstract representation, of patterns of behavior. That's what you do when you go to a movie. You watch people manifest their characteristic behaviors. And then you might note that there's characteristic, quasi-unique patterns of behavior that are portrayed in drama. So, for example, there's the bad guy, and he wears a black hat in a cowboy movie. And whenever you go to a movie, it's pretty clear to you right away who the good guys are and the bad guys are, and you accept the distinction between good and bad guys as an a priori acceptable distinction. So Jung would say, well, that's the action of an archetype. What underlies that is the archetypal story of the hostile brothers.
Now, according to Jung, we have built up these representations of archetypes in our unconscious, and this occurred over generations such that we mostly share the same deep archetypes in what Jung called the collective unconscious. Okay, the collective unconscious. Mm-hmm. And the content of the collective unconscious is something we inherited from our ancestors. And the goal then, according to Jung, is to tap into this collective unconscious in order to gain new knowledge about ourselves and about our psychology. And Jung's idea was that each person is really a fragmented collection of various archetypes. For instance, dudes, guys will have a feminine side, according to Jung, called the enema. Then they would have a public self called the mask. And then maybe also the dark side, which he called the shadow. And the goal throughout one's life, according to Jung, is to bring all these archetypes into consciousness. Okay, so from the unconscious into consciousness, and then to integrate them in a unified way to create a higher and fuller state of being. And Peterson sometimes calls this alignment, and Jung calls it individuation.
Yeah, Dan, we just want to make sure that that's anima instead of enema. It just it wasn't quite clear.
did I misspeak it?
You said it. Yeah. No, but it's kind of on the borderline, you know. It's not enema, but anima, as in like animal.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And you know.
Hold on a minute. Maybe one way you get in touch with your anima is by taking the psychedelic enema.
There you go. Maybe there's a connection. At least back to one of our older episodes anyways.
Yeah,
you know, it's Star Wars, right? That's exactly what that is. It's a story, at least the original series. It's a story about Luke Skywalker's individuation.
Yes.
Right? Princess Leia was the anima, right? The female side of Luke. And when he finds out that she is his sister, he is metaphorically incorporating her into his personality.
Yeah.
And Darth Vader is the shadow, Luke's dark side. And when Luke learns that Vader is his father, he's metaphorically incorporating that into himself.
Yes.
And you might remember there's that scene in which Luke is training and he goes into that cave and sees Darth Vader and he cuts his head off and then the face shield comes off and it's his own face. Well, that symbolizes Luke realizing his dark side.
Yeah, Dave, I remember when I first saw that. I remember when I first saw that scene, and I must have been about 12 or 13, and I had no idea what that scene was about. All I remember was that it freaked me out at the time. And actually, Darth Vader really freaked me out. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was undergraduate and took a course on personality in which I learned about Jung that I started to understand these scenes in the movies.
Yeah, yeah. That was a good course. Mm-hmm. I think we took that together, didn't we? I don't remember.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. Anyways, and the final thing I wanted to mention there is that as you go through the movie, you notice that Luke's got the white clothes, right?
Yeah.
He's clearly the good guy, but then at the end, he's wearing black.
Yes.
And that's when he has individuated and incorporated everything, including the dark side. And you'll see this kind of these themes even in the Star Wars, Clone Wars cartoons and all over the place in that series.
Yeah, the Star Wars story certainly comes more into focus once you understand Jung's ideas. And as you mentioned in an early episode, Dave, once you also understand Castaneda's writings on shamanism.
That's right, that's right. And that also brought a lot of that into light for me as well.
Yeah. And Peterson is very compelled by the philosophy and psychology of Carl Jung. And if you have been convinced by that already, here's another clip.
So, you know, I was convinced by Jung. It looked to me like his ideas about the relationship between dreams and mythology and drama and literature made sense to me, and the relationship between that and art.
Yeah, so Dan, the Jungian psychology stuff, it sounds interesting. It is interesting, but let's get into what motivated Jung to develop these ideas. And I think this is the really important part to know, because I think that some of our listeners might be shocked or even scandalized at some of Jung's inspirations.
Yeah, Dave, we'll have to bring in a lot of quotes from Jung and others to support what I'm going to say about Carl Jung, because without solid textual support, I think people might think that what I'm saying about this icon of psychology is simply unbelievable or incredible or maybe severely exaggerated. So perhaps you can help me read some of the quotes when they come up.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're going to be doing the heavy lifting on the Jung part anyway, so all I can do is pick up some of the quotes.
Okay, so I'll cue you by page number, okay?
Okay.
All right, so you can learn a lot about Jung from his memoir titled Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And I gather this was published after he died. It reads as an autobiography, but evidently it was more an edited compilation of Jung's work. It was edited by this, and I'm going to get the name wrong here, Anelia Jaffe, or Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E, who was the, quote, recorder and editor, end quote. Mm-hmm. And in any case, this autobiography is used as a primary source for understanding Jung's life, even though it's believed it was maybe heavily edited to cast Jung in a more positive light. For additional information about the life and work of Carl Jung, I also highly recommend the book titled The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung, written by clinical psychologist and Harvard lecturer Richard Knoll. I'm going to refer to some quotes from that book in what follows. Now, in Jung's memoir, Jung describes some formative experiences he had as a child. And one of these very formative experiences was a dream he had when he was a young boy. And he says he was about 3 to 4 years old, if I remember correctly, which is a little odd because we typically don't have solid memories from that age. But anyways, in this dream, and remember, dreams are very important for depth psychologists, Jung finds a hole in the ground of a meadow, and he goes down into the earth through that hole, and he finds himself in a large stone chamber with a golden throne. And now I'm quoting, quote, "Something was standing on it, on the throne, which I thought at first was a tree trunk, 12 to 15 feet high and about 1.5 to 2 feet thick." Then he adds, "It was made of skin and naked flesh, and on top there was something like a round head with no face and no hair. On the very top of the head was a single eye, gazing motionlessly upward," end quote. And Jung was haunted, as he says, by the dream for a long time, and only later did he realize that what he saw on the throne was a phallus. Yes, a big, ginormous penis. This is his interpretation.
Great.
And yeah, he struggled with the interpretation of this dream and ultimately settled on a meaning he describes on page 26. Dave, take it away.
He writes, "The phallus of this dream seems to be a subterranean god not to be named. And Such it remained throughout my youth, reappearing whenever anyone spoke too emphatically about Lord Jesus. Lord Jesus never became quite real for me, never quite acceptable, never quite lovable, for again and again I would think of his underground counterpart, a frightful revelation which had been accorded me without my seeking it.
So, he experiences a subterranean God that is not to be named. And by the way, Dave, there is no phallic God in my subterranean lair.
That's good to know.
I just want to be clear on that. Yeah. But what's that?
Did you hear what Chloe said when we were visiting you a couple of weeks back?
No, what'd she say?
She said, "Where's the guns?" I thought there'd be guns.
She thought there would be guns in the subterranean lair?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are no
too much Batman, I guess.
Yeah, there are no guns or weapons in my subterranean lair.
Just a lot of books.
Just a lot of books, which are really, really the true weapons. But in any case, what's interesting is that Jung interprets this dream in relation to Jesus. Okay, he says, Lord Jesus never became quite real for me. And particularly as a rejection or a dislike of Jesus and an affinity towards or an interest in some other God entity. And so, Dave, why don't you read the next quote?
All right. Through this childhood dream, I was initiated into the secrets of the earth. What happened then was a kind of burial in the earth, and many years were to pass before I came out again. Then he adds, it was an initiation into the realm of darkness. My intellectual life had its unconscious beginnings at that time.
Notice the shamanic language in Jung's interpretation of the dream. And for those who are joining us for the first time, you might want to listen to episode 8, in which we discuss shamanism. And anyways, he essentially goes into the underworld. He goes into the realm of darkness. He's initiated into secrets of the earth. And this experience is his intellectual beginning. And with this dream, Jung, I think, is communicating to his followers that he was initiated into some special secrets of the earth. And that makes him maybe a somebody special to listen to. And this is a theme we're going to keep returning to.
Yeah, by the way, Dan, Peterson also talks often about his transformative dreams and visions. Here's an example.
I had a vision once. I shouldn't tell you this, but I will anyways. I had a vision once that I went to heaven, and I was put in a Roman amphitheater with Satan, just like Thor, encountering the Hulk, right? That's coming up in that new Avengers movie. And so that was rather a shock, because I thought that was a hell of a thing to happen in heaven. And so I had this battle, and I won. And at the end, I came up to God and said, like, you know, what's with the whole Roman amphitheater thing there? It seemed like a bit over the top to me. I said, why would you put me in a ring with something like that? And he said, because I knew you could win. And, you know, I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, well, I do. He needs to stop watching Marvel movies before bed.
Yeah, but it's very tricky, right? He says, I don't know what to make of that. But he really knows what he's trying to imply by the dream, right? He knows exactly what the audience should make of that. The audience The audience should realize that he is this guy who's getting these visions from God, talking to God directly and representing God to them. Oh, my goodness. See, that's a part of the rhetorical device that he uses.
Absolutely, that's right. So here's another clip of Jordan Peterson with, it's a bunch of kings that kneel before Christ. Go ahead and roll that.
Okay, so this is another vision or dream, right?
Yeah.
I had a dream once, and I'm speaking psychologically here, not theologically. I had a dream once. I was in the cemetery of an old church, an old cathedral, surrounded by...
Okay, stop for a sec. Okay. Just, we'll roll it again, but he says, speaking psychologically, not theologically. I mean, there's no such thing, okay? If he's talking about spiritual things, he's talking theologically. Now, it might be bad theology, it might be heretical or blasphemous theology, but it's still theology, right? And we're going to have to come back to that when we get to the kind of more detailed analysis of his bib interpretation, but it's very important to keep this in mind, that there's no such thing as, oh, I'm not speaking theologically and then going on and talking about Jesus and God and all that kind
of stuff. That's right, and then inferring it's only psychologically. I think you can speak of things psychologically that are not theological, so you can imagine just the basic processes and memory or something like this. That's psychology, and that really is sort of independent of theology. But he specifically is addressing issues related to the nature of humanity, right? And the human experience, and the experience of gods and myths and so on. So in that case, I totally agree with you. You can't really separate psychology from theology.
Yeah, and you certainly can't just make an excuse yourself from theological criticism by just waving this, I'm speaking psychologically, magic wand.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. Anyways, go back to the beginning and roll it again. We'll get the whole thing.
All right.
I had a dream once, and I'm speaking psychologically here, not theologically. I had a dream once. I was in the cemetery of an old church, an old cathedral, surrounded by the graves, and there were indentations in the grounds where all the graves were, and all of a sudden the graves started to open, and it was a graveyard where great people, great men of the past had been buried, and so grave opened and an armed king stood up, and then another grave opened and another armed king stood up, and this happened all around me, and these were very formidable figures, right? They were the great heroes of the past, and after a number of them appeared on the scene, they looked around and saw each other, and being warrior types, they immediately started to fight. And the question is, what stops the great kings of the past from fighting? And I had a revelation after the dream. I can't remember if it was part of it, but it was part of the dream. They all bowed down to the figure of Christ, I thought. And then I woke up and I thought, what in the world does that dream mean? What in the world could that possibly mean? And then I understood it. I understood that if you have 20 kings, let's say, and you took the thing that was most king-like about each of them.
Just pause it for a sec. So first of all, what's the obvious Christian connection here, right? I mean, any Christian is going to think about maybe St. Paul writing to the Romans, where he writes, for it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. He's citing Isaiah 45 there, mm-hmm. or in Philippians chapter 2, St. Paul says again, you know, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, or something from Daniel or from Revelation. Instead, he goes off on this completely foreign to Christianity tangent. So go ahead and roll it and you can hear what he comes up with.
Bind it into a single figure, then you'd get a single figure of transcendent heroism, of transcendent good. And it's a tenet of the Jungian school of psychology, let's say, that figure of transcendent good is symbolized by the image of Christ. And the purpose of that image is so that even the tyrannical king has someone to bend his knee to.
Yeah, sure. And that last bit, that's the kernel of truth amidst all of this error, mm-hmm. with this idea that somehow all these kings are fused into a single figure of transcendent heroism, of transcendent good, symbolized by the image of Christ. This is complete nonsense. Anyway, I won't walk over these clips anymore. I just can't listen to this and not kind of jump in and jump all over it a little bit.
Yeah, Dave,
but,
do you notice,
got one more.
Do you notice, Dave, that he uses Jung? I think he named Jung, right? As the source of his interpretation.
Right.
So again, he's going to Jung archetypes when he goes to make the interpretation.
Yeah, that's right. There's one more clip that we should play. This is because the whole point here is the dreams. And this is a dream that he relates actually in the 12 rules, where he's in a cathedral. The audio on this is a little bit poor because it's coming from some kind of interview, but bear with it and just hear him out.
Mm-hmm.
Writing Maps of Meaning, your first book, that you were hanging from a chandelier in a cathedral with tiny little people below, and you woke up in your bed and you still saw cathedral doors. Close your eyes again, you're back in the center of the cathedral. Was that vision a sign from God? Or was it the fever dream of an academic who's been thinking too much, and is there a difference?
Well, I'm not sure there's a difference. I mean, it took me a long time to understand what the dream meant, but I eventually did. I mean,
what? He says, I'm not sure there's a difference between getting a getting a message from God and a feverish dream of an academic? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Talk about delusions of grandeur there, man. My feverish dreams are messages from God, Dave. Okay, here, let's finish it.
Why don't you try that in lecture?
I know. Okay, let's listen to the rest of this.
I knew at that point, or I had figured out as part of the process of interpreting that dream, let's say, that cathedrals were constructed in the shape of a cross. And so to be hanging at the center of the cross, which is essentially where the dream put me, was, well, obviously, you know, that's something that can be read in terms of its fundamental religious significance. But that isn't the most appropriate level of analysis, I would say.
Okay, so what is? I mean, if
yeah, he goes on to give a Jungian.
That's not the appropriate level of analysis.
Yeah, he goes on to give a Jungian analysis.
Right, and that's one of the points we're trying to make here, I think, in terms of the influences on Peterson's interpretation of the Bible.
Yeah, and notice he puts himself on the cross. That's also very interesting.
Yeah, in the center of the whole thing, right?
Yeah, Dave, I think that like Jung, Peterson is really communicating that he's getting some special knowledge, and because his dreams involve Jesus, crosses, and talking to God, he's effectively claiming he has access to some special deep underlying knowledge and that he's maybe even getting authoritative revelations that he has to share with the masses.
Yeah, I think the way that's the way Peterson sees himself. I mean, notice that he says, I had a revelation after that dream. He uses that very word.
Yeah.
And, Vox Dei makes this point also in Jordanetics. He says Peterson has a messiah complex and he sees himself as a savior figure, and he points to a letter that Peterson wrote to his father that's recorded in his other book, Maps of Meaning, which basically says that much, right? That as much that Peterson sees himself as a savior of sorts.
Yeah, I think that's probably an accurate analysis to some extent. But returning to Jung, Dave, Jung as a boy, he had another key vision, which he again framed in terms of rejecting Christianity and the Christianity of his father, the preacher, which, as we talked about before, his father later perhaps rejected. So on page 39 of his biography, Jung describes feeling compelled to have a blasphemous thought that he couldn't hold back. And so he just let that thought come. And here is how he describes it. Quote, I gathered all my courage as though I were about to leap forthwith into hellfire and let the thought come. I saw before me the cathedral, the blue sky. God sits on his golden throne, high above the world, and from under the throne an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the walls of the cathedral asunder. End quote.
I wonder what Freud would say about this scatological fascination.
That's right. We could call it the turd dream. So in this, so his interpretation of this vision is again very informative. This is Jung's interpretation. He believes that God made him have this terrible thought, and he argues if you read around the following pages and the preceding pages of the description of this dream or this thought, he argues that Adam and Eve were in a similar dilemma. They could only do what God made them do. And so, and I'm quoting here, quote, therefore, it was God's intention that they should sin, end quote. So he believed that God wanted him, like Adam and Eve, to do wrong, and that God forced him, and I'm quoting again, forced him to think abominations in order to experience his grace. Okay, that was a direct quote. So anyways, he came to the conclusion that God forces people to do evil. And so we heard earlier that Jung believes in a non-Jesus underworld God, and he believes that God forces people to do evil. And later he writes, quote, why did God befoul his cathedral? That for me was a terrible thought. But then came the dim understanding that God could be something terrible. I had experienced a dark and terrible secret. It overshadowed my whole life, and I became deeply pensive. end quote.
Yeah, notice how contrary this is to Christianity, where St. Paul's writing to the Romans, and he says, he's talked about this whole business of grace, and then he says, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means, right? How can we who died to sin still live in it? So this whole idea that God made him sin to so that he could have more grace, this is completely contrary to Christianity. And notice also the emphasis on the subjective experience versus the objective revelation. So he's got the subjective revelation, which he elevates, instead of the objective, the external, the extranos, the outside of ourselves revelation of God's word, against which all personal experiences must be tested and evaluated. And that's the position of historic Christianity on these kinds of experiences.
Yeah, and this links also to his whole desire for secrets. He always wanted to, one of the reasons why he rejected Jesus was because there was no secret surrounding Jesus. He kind of told everybody who he was, but he loved these secrets. And he says the following quote, "With the experience of God in the cathedral, I at last had something tangible that was part of the great secret." And then later he says, "My entire youth can be understood in terms of this secret." So it's some sort of a secretive relationship with this God that's not Jesus.
Yeah. And essentially, Jung here is being very Gnostic, right? And the Gnostics in the early centuries of Christianity were all about secret knowledge that only the initiated could access. And this is directly in contrast to Christianity, where there are no secrets. I mean, God has laid it out all in the scriptures for anyone to read.
Yes.
In John's gospel, Jesus is being questioned by the high priest about his teaching, and he replies, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said to them." And that's, again, that's the position of Orthodox historic Christianity, that there's no hidden knowledge that is not accessible to the whole world and open for everyone to see.
Yes. And you mentioned Gnosticism, and there are definitely Gnostic elements in Jung's worldview. I should also add here this. Jung claimed to have a direct connection with God through his dreams, his visions, and his mystical experiences. And here's a quote. "Nobody could rob me of the conviction that it was enjoined upon me to do what God wanted and not what I wanted. That gave me the strength to go my own way. Often I had the feeling that in all decisive matters, I was no longer among men, but was alone with God. And when I was there, where I was no longer alone, I was outside time. I belonged to the centuries. And he who then gave answer was he who had always been, who had been before my birth. He who always is was there. These talks with the other, in quotations, were my profoundest experiences. On the one hand, a bloody struggle; on the other, supreme ecstasy." End quote. Notice that he says he belonged to the centuries when he was in this what amounts to a mystical state, and he's having conversations with this other who is not Jesus, right? So, according to Jung himself, he is in communication with and being controlled by a God. He shares some secretive communion with this God. And he's even sent out to do this God's will. But who is this God?
Yeah, well, it can't be the Christian God, because Jung repeatedly disparages Jesus, right?
Well, exactly. And so earlier he writes, "While it became increasingly impossible for me to adopt a positive attitude to Lord Jesus, I remembered that from the time I was 11, the idea of God began to interest me." End quote. So he had this deep connection with a God that was not the Christian God.
Yeah, and I don't know if our listeners heard it, but he refuses to use the definite article. It's not the Lord Jesus, as you'd see it anywhere in the Bible or in Christian writings. It's just Lord Jesus.
Yeah, and this occurs throughout his memoirs book, and I'll quote it again here. So he says, "Became increasingly impossible for me to adopt a positive attitude to Lord Jesus." So there's no the Lord Jesus. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, but Dave, listen, we're only scratching the surface of the weird stuff that surrounds Carl Jung, okay? So, we're about an hour in, let's say, but buckle up, because for the next few minutes, it's going to get a little bumpy, all right?
Okay.
So in his memoir, Jung writes about a series of paranormal events that occurred in his house while he was a child. And evidently, there was a lot of weird stuff that surrounded his mother. All right. So, Dave, why don't you read the quote from page 32 of Memories?
I should first mention that the nocturnal atmosphere had begun to thicken. All sorts of things were happening at night, things incomprehensible and alarming. My parents were sleeping apart. I slept in my father's room. From the door to my mother's room came frightening influences. At night, mother was strange and mysterious. One night, I saw coming from her door a faintly luminous, indefinite figure whose head detached itself from the neck and floated along in front of it in the air like a little moon. Immediately, another head was produced and again detached itself. This process was repeated 6 or 7 times.
Crazy, right? So it turns out, and you can read about this in Dr. Noel's book about Jung, that Jung's mother was very likely some sort of a psychic or a clairvoyant and perhaps a spirit seer. And Jung's cousin, Helen Praiswerk, known as Heli, which is kind of funny, right? Because so related to the word hell, who was, by the way, from Jung's mother's side, was also a medium. So Heli was a medium. And as history has it, Jung, Heli, and a few others would participate in seances. And on these occasions, Heli would fall into trances and channel the spirits of the dead. And in one case, if I remember correctly, she channels the spirit of her grandfather. And while she's doing this, she would take on a completely different voice. For example, in that case, like the voice of an old man, she would sound like an old man. So this sounds to me like a full-on demonic possession, a demonically infested seance.
Yeah, definitely. The ability of the person to speak with voices not their own is one of the 8 marks of demon possession described in Kurt Koch's book, Demonology, Past and Present. So I would agree with you fully there.
Yeah. And so Jung was already as a young man, neck deep in these occult practices. And this is where it gets kind of interesting. Ultimately, he writes his dissertation, okay, his doctoral dissertation. He writes it on his cousin Heli and her spirit possessions. But when he does so,
wow.
Yeah, when he does so, he describes Heli's spirit channelings in strictly psychological, air quotes, terms. And here's what Richard Knoll writes, quote, from 1902 onwards, and that, by the way, that was when Jung's dissertation came out, in his professional publications, Jung referred to spirits as unconscious personalities, splinter personalities, or complexes. In other words, spirits and other paranormal phenomena became only so-called, not at all genuine. Since complexes operate unconsciously, the spirit world of the mediums is given a new place name, the unconscious, in quotes there, okay? So the unconscious is now the new spirit world. And I think this is a very clever move because Jung later argued that because the unconscious is a collective unconscious, in other words, that it's inherited, that it's shared with your ancestors, then you could actually have contact with your ancestors through the collective unconscious. And the clever part is that he cloaks these pagan ideas of contacting, like, let's say, your dead ancestors in psychological language. Jung's language, by the way, Dave, is always veiled. It's always vague. It's metaphorical, but with intimations that it might not really be metaphorical, but it might be. Who knows? Okay. And by communicating in this vague, obfuscating way, Jung was able to convey what amount to be pagan spiritistic ideas veiled by a mask of scientific psychology and a language, scientific language that he created.
Yeah, interesting. Peterson uses that tactic as well, right?
Yeah.
He's deliberately vague and he always sort of qualifies things with, oh, it's something like that, or as far as I can tell.
Yes.
Or, you know, that's one way to think about it. He does that. In fact, why don't you roll that compilation of those?
Yeah, we've got a compilation of statements here.
It's something like that, but it's something like that. It's something like that. It's something like that.
They all sound the same, Dave. Those were 4 completely different clips from different parts of his lectures, but they all sound the same. He's always saying the same thing. And then here's one that you added to the mix.
As far as I can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, he uses that a lot as well. Yeah, and then Peter Essen adds the language of evolution, yes. Right? So this collective unconscious is something that emerged over the process of evolution, and that's how it's supposedly validated.
It's something like that.
It's something like that.
Right. Something like that, exactly. Actually, Dan, you know what? We should just edit this part out because we don't want to give away the secret, right? This is a great way to punt when you either don't want to or can't clearly articulate your point. You just go, oh, it's something like that.
Something
right?
Like that.
This would be this would just make our podcast a heck of a lot easier.
We just throw it so vague.
Just cut this part right out and keep it under wraps.
Yeah, we just throw something vague out there and then just say,
it's something like that.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going on with Jung here. So early on, Jung has some mystical experiences. In fact, in one case, he depersonalizes while he's still a young boy. And at one point, he starts to believe that he is two different people that live at two different time periods, one living in the late 1800s and the other living in the 1700s. And he writes the following, and I'm picking up mid-sentence here, quote, I began pondering these isolated impressions and they coalesced into a coherent picture of myself living in two ages simultaneously and being two different persons, end quote. And he later, on page 45, calls these personalities personality number one and personality number two. He just calls them, just enumerates them, personality number one, personality number two. Number one was the schoolboy, and number two was able to enter another realm. And he writes the following.
Wow. Dan, before you go on with that, this helps me understand the TV series, The 12 Monkeys, because it's a time travel thing. And this is exactly one of the subtexts in the whole thing with this, the bad guy character called The Witness. Anyways, that's another aside, but we see this is, it's basically pure Jungian, red book materials. This is where this
personality
stuff comes
splitting.
From,
so this is just this, from his memoirs. But yeah, it's personality splitting. I got to go see the 12 Monkeys again. Was it the movie or the show?
Yeah, it's not the movie. Oh, okay. This is a show. It's a show. Yeah.
That's interesting because the show is more recent, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, here's a quote. Besides his world, there existed another realm, like a temple in which anyone who entered was transformed and suddenly overpowered by a vision of the whole cosmos so that he could only marvel and admire, forgetful of himself. Here lived the other, in quotes, who knew God as hidden, personal, and at the same time, supra-personal secret. Here nothing separated man from God. And a few lines later, he adds, as soon as I was alone, I could pass over into this state. I therefore sought the peace and solitude of this other personality number two, end quote. And by the way, he says that in this other state, he, quote, knew God as a hidden secret, right? And this is that recurring theme in his autobiography. He found, again, Jesus to be not that interesting because he was not a secret. And Jung craved to have some secret experience with an unknown God.
Yeah, so there you have it again, that Gnosticism, right?
Yes.
Now, again, I want to bring Peterson into this because Peterson also talks about having his personality split in two. And so I want you to roll that clip on split personality.
I guess it was because I was trying to figure out who I was and how that could be fixed. Something like that.
Something like that.
I started to pay very careful attention to what I was saying. I don't know if that happened voluntarily or involuntarily, but I could feel a sort of split developing in my psyche. And the split, and I've actually had students tell me the same thing that has happened to them after they've listened to some of the material that I've been describing to all of you. But I split into two, let's say. And one part was the, let's say, the old me that was talking a lot and that liked to argue and that liked ideas. And there was another part that was watching that part, like just with its eyes open and neutrally judging. And the part that was neutrally judging was watching the part that was talking and going, that isn't your idea. You don't really believe that. You don't really know what you're talking about. That isn't true. And I thought, that's really interesting. So now and that was happening to like 95% of what I was saying. And so then I didn't really know what to do. I thought, okay, this is strange. So maybe I've fragmented and that's just not a good thing at all. I mean, it wasn't like I was hearing voices or anything like that. I mean, it wasn't like that. Well, people have multiple parts. So then I had this weird conundrum. It was like, well, which of these two things are me? Is it the part that's listening and saying, no, that's rubbish, that's a lie, you're doing that to impress people, you're just trying to win the argument, you know? Was that me, or was the part that was going about my normal verbal business me? And I didn't know, but I decided I would go with the critic.
So that's an interesting story, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is that Peterson encourages this kind of splitting in his 12 rules to his audience and his readers. And this is a point that, again, is made by Vox Day in his book, Jordanetics. And he's critiquing rule number 4, which is compare yourself to who you were yesterday and not to who you were, not to who someone else is today. And Vox writes this. He says, while modifying one's internal monologue to stress positivity instead of incessant negativity and self-criticism is known to be beneficial, Peterson isn't actually describing normal self-talk here. He's going a step beyond that in advising his reader to enter into a stage of cognitive disassociation, as if the second part of the dialogue is not the reader himself, but some kind of demon of whom the reader must be wary and with whom the reader must negotiate. And I mean, this is the problem with this kind of disassociation, and it's the problem with all this internal self-absorption that Peterson advocates in his 12 rules. Right, the Christian answer to most psychological problems, at least these kind, anyways, is not to go deeper into your head and get lost in self-analysis or in your own internal world. It's to get out of yourself. Right? Yes. To focus on what God has done for you in Christ, to focus on what you can do to serve your neighbor. And in the Christian framework, the whole problem of sin is this being curved in on self, right? This incurvatus se, which is Latin for turned in or curved inward on self, that Luther talks about and that Augustine, I think, also talked about. So it's all backwards, and it has potentially dangerous ramifications.
Yeah. And the depth psychologists are all about curving in on the self. You know, you're supposed to look into yourself and interpret things and make deep connections and interpretations. But, you know, the best case scenario there is that you're making a bunch of stuff up and that you're harping on something that happened in the past. And the worst case scenario is you're contacting some sort of a demon who's negotiating with you about your life.
Yeah. That's right. And I think Vox has got a point here that these dialogues that Peterson describes are kind of weirdly disassociated, and you got to wonder what's really involved here.
Yes. You know, Peterson, I think, here is not exactly like Jung. This experience is not exactly like Jung's experience of splitting, but it's the same general idea. In both cases, there is the experience of a split in personality and an attempt to figure out which one of two personalities is the real person. And I really do get the sense that by imitating Jung with regard to having a split personality, and also with regard to sharing and interpreting his profound dreams, and I'm using air quotes here around profound, I think Peterson is telegraphing to his audience that he is like Jung. And as he has had experiences that have brought him to a higher level of being, and that he has received special knowledge that he now has to share with others. One could say that, like Jung, you know, Peterson is the archetypal shaman.
Hey, Dan, we got to capture that in the title of this episode. I mean, something like the archetypal Jordan Peterson, or the archetypal Peterson, or something like that.
Yeah, the archetypal Jordan Peterson. I like that. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, because he's essentially the archetype of Jung, and Jung's the archetype of the shaman, and so on. And just that, very interesting.
I think that'd be good.
Okay, Dave, a few more minutes here, because things get even nuttier with Jung as he gets older. So as an adult, Jung claimed, that he experienced deeply convincing visions, as he called them, again, in air quotes of visions, while using a technique that he called active imagination. And Dr. Richard Knoll, the Harvard lecturer that I mentioned earlier, distinctly links Jung's technique of active imagination to the occult practices of the maternal side of his family. The praise works, he writes, quote, from the praise works, he, Jung, learned the techniques for his own form of mediumship, a practice he would legitimize in Zurich in 1916 with the term active imagination, end quote.
Yeah, and it sounds very similar to Castaneda's The Art of Dreaming, where he describes this altered state to gain knowledge and to learn sorcery. And in fact, we had a quote in a previous episode from Castaneda, where Castaneda apparently wrote his books not as a literary exercise, but as an exercise in sorcery. And it was this altered state of quote unquote dreaming, where he would get the, he would just basically see the stuff come forward. So yeah, I totally, I think that there's a real connection there.
Yeah, it seems like it's all coming from the same place. It's got the same dubious same source.
Fingerprints, yeah.
Yeah, and now Jung, you know, he would get into these, he would have these visions, he would meet these characters and talk with these characters, right, in his visions. And as I read Jung's description of his experiences, it seems to me that he believed, at least to some extent, that the characters he was contacting during his active imaginings were in some sense real, and that they weren't just imagined. And Dave, on page 217, if you can go to that, of his autobiography, Jung describes some of the characters he encounters in his visions. And maybe you can read this passage. I think it's important to listen to Jung's own descriptions of these characters that spoke to him in the visions. And the quote starts with Jung meeting one of the characters in his vision.
The old man explained that he was Elijah, and that gave me a shock. But the girl staggered me even more, for she called herself Salome. She was blind. What a strange couple, Salome and Elijah. But Elijah assured me that he and Salome belonged together from all eternity, which completely astounded me. They had a black serpent living with them, which displayed an unmistakable fondness for me. I stuck close to Elijah because he seemed to be the more reasonable of the three, to have a clear intelligence. Of Salome, I was distinctly suspicious. Elijah and I had a long conversation, which, however, I did not understand.
Yeah, keep going.
Soon after this fantasy, another figure rose out of the unconscious. He developed out of the Elijah figure. I called him Philemon. Philemon was a pagan and brought with him an Egypto-Hellenistic atmosphere with a Gnostic coloration. His figure first appeared to me in the following dream. There was a blue sky like the sea, covered not by clouds, but by flat brown clods of earth. It looked as if the clods were breaking apart and the blue water of the sea were becoming visible between them, but the water was the blue sky. Suddenly there appeared from the right a winged being sailing across the sky. I saw that it was an old man with the horns of a bull. He held a bunch of four keys, one of which he clutched as if he were about to open a lock. He had the wings of the kingfisher with its characteristic colors.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So Richard Knoll points out that Jung's description of Philemon is similar to the Aryan Mithric king and sun god Aion. And I looked this up, and Mithraism is a Roman mystery cult that was evidently very popular in the first century AD. And the reason why Knoll titles his book The Aryan Christ is because at some point Jung starts to have these visions that in fact he might be this Aryan Mithric god king, or that he sort of is in direct communication with them, or may even be him to some extent. And so that's why the book is called The Aryan Christ. In any case, let's read the next few quotes.
Philemon became relativized by the emergence of yet another figure whom I called Ka. In ancient Egypt, the king's Ka was his earthly form, the embodied soul. In my fantasy, the Ka soul came from below, out of the earth, as if out of a deep shaft. Philemon had a lame foot, but was a winged spirit, whereas Ka represented a kind of earth demon or metal demon. Philemon was the spiritual aspect or meaning. Ka, on the other hand, was a spirit of nature like the Anthroparion of Greek alchemy, with which at the time I was still unfamiliar.
Yeah, thanks. So one could say that Jung was getting into some sort of meditative trance, essentially functioning like a medium, as Knoll suggests, during which he channeled or made contact with these ancient gods like Aion and Ka. And he actually called them, he calls them spirits and demons directly. And some of these even came out of a deep shaft, Dave.
Yeah. Anyone who's read Revelation in the Bible knows that nothing good comes out of a deep shaft.
You want to stay away from those deep shafts. Yeah. By the way, Dave, from his early years, Jung was enamored with a book that showed illustrations of the Hindu gods, gods like Brahma and Vishnu and Shiva. And he would apparently return to this book quite frequently. And he wrote the following, quote, "Whenever I did so, I had an obscure feeling of their affinity with my original revelation, which I never spoke of to anyone," end quote. And so remember, the original revelation was the underground penis god. So I think he's now linking basically his phallic god with the Hindu gods and all sorts of, you know, he's being spoken to or interacting with all these Egyptian gods and the Roman gods. I mean, this guy is connected, but in a very negative way.
Yeah. And Dan, I should have mentioned earlier, but in the Old Testament times, the Canaanite, the male fertility gods, the Baals, essentially had a phallic stone for their idol, right? That's how they were represented. And of course, these Old Testament gods of the Canaanites and the other nations weren't just something made up. These represented the spiritual entities that were opposed to the creator god.
Yes.
Right. And so whatever Jung was messing around with, it shouldn't be taken lightly or just dismissed as a fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah. The way that Jung describes being inspired to write some of his works even sounds very much like he was possessed by a spirit or even multiple spirits and demonic ones at that, and that they then motivated him to write. They essentially maybe even dictated what he was to write. In fact, he explicitly states that the idea for one of his works titled Septum Sermones Ad Mortuos, and I'm probably butchering that completely, but anyways, it translates to Seven Sermons of the Dead, was inspired by an entity within him, and I think it was the one called Philemon, which he then kind of wrote right after an actual haunting experience.
Wow.
Yeah. These seven sermons he published as being authored by the Gnostic teacher Basilides of Alexandria. So he actually didn't sign it himself. He gave it this other name of this Gnostic teacher as the author. Totally bizarre.
Yeah.
Here's what he wrote in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. Quote, "Very gradually, the outlines of an inner change began making their appearance within me. In 1916, I felt an urge to give shape to something. I was compelled from within, as it were, to formulate and express what might have been said by Philemon. This was how the Septum Sermones Ad Mortuos, with its peculiar language, came into being. It began with a restlessness, but I did not know what it meant or what they wanted of me. There was an ominous atmosphere all around me. I had the strange feeling that the air was filled with ghostly entities. Then it was as if my house began to be haunted. My eldest daughter saw a white figure passing through the room. My second daughter, independently of her elder sister, related that twice in the night her blanket had been snatched away. And that same night, my 9-year-old son had an anxiety dream. In the morning, he asked his mother for crayons, and he, who ordinarily never drew, now made a picture of his dream. He called it the picture of the fisherman. Through the middle of the picture ran a river, and a fisherman with a rod was standing on the shore. He had caught a fish. On the fisherman's head was a chimney from which flames were leaping and smoke rising. From the other side of the river, the devil came flying through the air. He was cursing because his fish had been stolen. But above the fisherman hovered an angel who said, 'You cannot do anything to him. He only catches the bad fish.' My son drew this picture on a Saturday. Around 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, the front doorbell began ringing frantically. It was a bright summer day. The two maids were in the kitchen, from which the open square outside the front door could be seen. Everyone immediately looked to see what was there, but there was no one in sight. I was sitting near the doorbell and not only heard it, but saw it moving. We all simply stared at one another. The atmosphere was thick, believe me. Then I knew that something had to happen. The whole house was filled as if there were a crowd present, crammed, full of spirits. They were packed deep right up to the door, and the air was so thick it was scarcely possible to breathe. As for myself, I was all aquiver with the question, 'For God's sake, what in the world is this?' Then they cried out in chorus, 'We have come back from Jerusalem where we found not what we sought.' That is the beginning of the Septum Sermones. Then it began to flow out of me, and in the course of 3 evenings, the thing was written. As soon as I took up the pen, the whole ghostly assemblage evaporated. The room quieted, and the atmosphere cleared. The haunting was over. End quote.
That's demonic!
Yikes.
Yeah, so as you can see, from the Christian perspective, one might say that there are clear overtones here of demonic activity, and I think that we could venture to say that during his active imagination sessions, Jung was even possessed. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I would agree. Again, I'll mention Castaneda and The Art of Dreaming, which definitely has encounters with demonic entities as core part of the experience. Mm-hmm. And in one case, there's a description of what I would call a demonic possession. So this is it's all coming from the same ilk, as we said earlier. And frankly, there's all these visualization techniques that are popular nowadays, which involve creating your inner space, your inner room, where you can encounter your spirit guide and such. And sometimes yoga practitioners go into this category. It's all cut from the same cloth. And it all has these spiritual encounters, which are potentially very dangerous.
Yeah, Dave, can you just quickly look up while we're talking Jung and automatic writing? Because I think one of the techniques that Jung used was just to get into these sort of trances and then just start writing whatever came to mind, which is essentially like getting some sort of a dictation or revelation.
Yeah, right. And Peterson does this too, right? So, yeah, it's sketchy thing.
We got to find some clips of Peterson doing that. Yeah. Okay. While you're Googling that, I want to read a few passages from Jung's Red Book, which evidently he channeled in one of these trances. And I gather that the 7 sermons to the dead are part of the Red Book. And here's what he says in the Red Book. So this is what's coming to him. Quote, "The spirit of this time whispered to me, this supreme meaning, this image of God, this melting together of the hot and the cold, that is you and only you. But the spirit of the depth spoke to me, you are an image of the unending world. All the last mysteries of becoming and passing away live in you. The way is within us, but not in gods, nor in teachings, nor in laws. Within us is the way, the truth, and the life. May each go his own way." And I'm just skipping some parts here and reading some phrases. He says, "Give humanity dignity and trust that life will find the better way. The one eye of the Godhead is blind. The one ear of the Godhead is deaf. The order of its being is crossed by chaos." End quote. And then he goes on to say, "Christ totally overcomes the temptation of the devil, but not the temptation of God to good and reason. Christ thus succumbs to cursing." You still have to learn this, to succumb to no temptation, but to everything of your own will. Then you will be free and beyond Christianity. End quote. Now, that's pretty frightening, eh, Dave?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It definitely has anti-Christian overtones. So you wanted me to look up some automatic writing stuff? Do you want that now?
Yeah, sure.
So, I don't know where this is. This is from some Seeker project. Automatic writing is a powerful way to connect with our subconscious mind. Learn how this process can benefit your inner work.
What is automatic writing?
Yeah, that's right. It talks about how Jung used this. And there's another, this is even interesting. This is an article. It's from Eye of the Psychic. And the automatic writings of Jung, feature articles. Carl Gustav Jung is notorious for being more liberal in his psychology than his friend Freud. But what is less known is that Jung was more of an alchemist and Gnostic than a psychotherapist. And it talks about this Watkins bookstore, which is still the premier hermetic bookstore. And when we get into the pagan stuff, we got to talk about hermeticism as well, because it's like the alchemy that we've talked about.
We're going to get to alchemy in a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is it's all connected, right? And, it's interesting because this is where Jung apparently went, and this is where he purportedly published that text, the Basilides of Alexandria, this Gnostic text, religious document. It says largely Christian in nature. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways, it's interesting, but it's connected to Jung, and I know for a fact that it's connected to Peterson does this as well. He's got the the goofy pen.
Yeah, that's so, right. And so what's inspiring those things that they're writing, right? So for instance, here from the quotes from the red book that I just read, he says, within us is the way, the truth, and the life. Dave, what does the Bible say?
Yeah, that's right. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
That's right.
No he man says, comes to the Father except through me, right? So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's got these spirits speaking to him, and note that he's being told to follow his own will, right? And then he'll be free from Christianity. So it's distinctly, clearly anti-Christian. And is that Jung or is that the spirit that's possessing him? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Now, Dave, do you remember Peterson's description of Jung as being prone to vivid fantasies and dreams? Right at the beginning, remember I played that. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, right. Yep.
I think it's fair to say that Peterson's presentations of Jung's visions was a bit of a whitewash.
Watch out for the fresh paint covering up the dark stain. Whitewash!
For Jung, his visions, what might seem to us as demonic possessions, form the basis of his psychology and his teaching. And in fact, he says, quote, today I can say that I have never lost touch with my initial experiences. All my works, all my creative activity has come from these initial fantasies and dreams, which began in 1912, almost 50 years ago. Everything that I accomplished in later life was already contained in them, although at first only in the form of emotions and images, end quote. So you see, these revelations that he received under these trances through these visions, they are the basis of his psychology. And Jung explicitly linked his psychological approach to, and Dave just mentioned this a moment ago, the practice of alchemy. Mm-hmm. And our young listeners might think of alchemists as just chemists who are trying to figure out a way to change one metal to another, right? Change, you know, some metal to gold. Well, it turns out that in some circles, alchemy involved more than just mixing of metals. The practice of alchemy by some groups actually had a strong and fundamental spiritual aspect that included the idea of spiritual transformation and the attainment of a higher knowledge. And for some, the transformation of metals was only actually a metaphor for a much deeper spiritual transformation, and it was just a metaphor for spiritual ideas. Now, Dave, can you read from pages 244 and 245 in the Kindle edition of Memories, where Jung describes how his psychology related to alchemy?
Yeah, this is a good quote here. I had very soon seen that analytical psychology coincided in a most curious way with alchemy. The experiences of the alchemists were, in a sense, my experiences, and their world was my world. This was, of course, a momentous discovery. I had stumbled upon the historical counterpart of my psychology of the unconscious. The possibility of a comparison with alchemy and the uninterrupted intellectual chain back to Gnosticism gave substance to my psychology. When I pored over these old texts, everything fell into place. The fantasy images, the empirical material I had gathered in my practice, and the conclusions I had drawn from it. I now began to understand what these psychic contents meant when seen in historical perspective. My understanding of their typical character, which had already begun with my investigations of myths, was deepened. The primordial images and the nature of the archetype took a central place in my researches, and it became clear to me that without history, there can be no psychology, and certainly no psychology of the unconscious.
Yes, and so Jung embraced mythology, paganism, and alchemy, and with that he completely rejected Christianity. And just as another quote he wrote, I have explained the myths of people of the past. I had written a book about the hero, the myth in which man has always lived, but in what myth does man live nowadays? In the Christian myth, the answer might be, do you live in it? I asked myself. To be honest, the answer was no. For me, it is not what I live by. So he's rejecting the Christian myth. And I think a great summary, Dave, of Jung's worldview and the origins of his psychology is provided by Richard Knoll, this Harvard lecturer that we've been quoting. And he writes the following. Okay, listen very carefully because this is the money quote.
All right.
Through years of reflection on Jung's considerable impact on the culture and spiritual landscape of the 20th century, I've come to the conclusion that as an individual, he ranks with the Roman Emperor Julian the Apostate, 4th century CE, as one who significantly undermined Orthodox Christianity and restored the polytheism of the Hellenistic world in Western civilization. He goes on to say, I believe that for a variety of historical and technological factors, modern mass media being the most important, Jung has succeeded where Julian failed. For the first 60 years of his life, the period of his secret life largely lost to history, Jung was openly hostile to Judeo-Christian orthodoxies, particularly Judaism and Roman Catholicism. Contemporaneously, the patriarchal monotheism of the Orthodox Judeo-Christian faith has all but collapsed. Filling that void, however, we increasingly find Protestants, Catholics, and Jews adopting alternative syncretic belief systems that often belie a basis in Jungian psychological, in quotation marks, theories. He then says, I place the term psychological in quotation marks because I believe and argue in this book that this 20th century mask was constructed deliberately and somewhat deceptively by Jung to make his own magical, polytheist, pagan worldview more palatable to a secularized world conditioned to respect only those ideas that seem to have a scientific air to them. I make this judgment about Jung without being either Christian or Jew or Muslim or Freudian. And then he's, yeah, that's right. And then he says, evidence, and there's much of it, reveals Jung to have been an acutely self-conscious heresiarch, much like Julian the Apostate, with whom Jung believed he was an initiate into a 4th century mystical brotherhood. Like Julian, for many years, Jung presented himself as a Christian, but in private practiced paganism, end quote. So Jung masked his pagan and mythical worldview by, first of all, psychological language with terms like archetype, the collective unconscious, and active imagination. And second, by publicly still using Christian metaphors, even though he personally rejected Christianity. Yet from behind the mask, he continued to sow the seeds of paganism throughout his teaching. And I want to now link this back again to Peterson, because Jung was perhaps Peterson's strongest influence. And just remember these quotes that we played before.
So, you know, I was convinced by Jung. It looked to me like his ideas about the relationship between dreams and mythology and drama and literature made sense to me, and the relationship between that and art.
Listen to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's conceivable, I think, perhaps probable, that nothing more important conceptually happened in the 20th century than that. Because it was the first time post-Enlightenment that a rapprochement between the intellect and the underlying religious archetypal substructure occurred. You have in the capacious intellect of Jung, and the same thing happened to some degree with Piaget.
He mentions Jung.
The religious domain and the factual domain were brought back together. And the fact of Jung's enduring and increasing popularity and influence, I would say, is a direct consequence of that.
Increasing popularity and influence, right? So this is something that Peterson sees as actually, you know, getting stronger, the influence getting stronger. This is a worldview that's coming back and it's emerging on the world stage stronger than it has before. Here's just one more reminder about how much Peterson loves Jung.
I'm not sure I've ever read anyone as intelligent as Jung, except maybe Nietzsche.
So Peterson is clearly a disciple of Jung, and therefore we have to say of Jung's paganism. But to me, an important question that remains is, I truly don't have an answer to this, Dave. Question is Peterson deliberately and cunningly trying to sell a cloaked paganism as Jung did, or is Peterson just, maybe we could say, a useful idiot, as the term goes, and an unwitting modern conduit of Jung's pagan teachings?
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I mean, on one level, it really doesn't matter, because both of these paths lead to paganism.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, and there are certainly some, like Vox Dei, who thinks that Peterson is out to create his own religion, and that's why his book is titled Jordanetics, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, in the final chapter of the book, this is what he writes here. Just give me a sec, I got to find it here. Here's the inescapable conclusion is that Jordan Peterson is a mentally ill occultist who seeks to save the world from nuclear destruction.
He's a mentally ill occultist.
He's a mentally ill occultist who seeks to save the world from nuclear destruction by uniting the nations of man under a single global government through a collective devotion to his esoteric religious philosophy. So at least Vox Dei would come down on the side that this is, he's not just a useful idiot, he's actually deliberately, cunningly doing this. And he makes a pretty good argument in the book, because there's stuff that Peterson has written on for the United Nations and on globalism, stuff that people don't even have a clue about generally, but that's there to be read. And of course, his book Maps of Meaning and whatever. So,
yeah.
So,
Dave,
which has,
we're going to need another episode to deal with all this stuff. And it seems like we're working in trilogies.
I think so, Dan.
Yeah, we always do this in threes. Yeah.
That's right. So if you're still with us in this episode, join us for the next episode, and we're getting, because I have got a whole segment on Peterson's examples of what Peterson does with scripture, mm-hmm. and we do want to kind of paint the picture there to make it very clear as to what Peterson's position on the Bible is. So we'll do it in his own words and what he does.
Yeah, that's going to be very important. So,
yeah.
So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode 3 in this trilogy on Jordan Peterson. But let me just do a quick summary, Dave, and then you can take us out. Okay. So
sure. Yeah.
In this episode, we tried to capture the extensive influence that Jung had on Peterson's teachings. Jung was a deeply troubled person who rejected Christianity and tried to rebrand paganism in a psychological language. We see Jung's influence on the content of Peterson's philosophy, and Peterson also seems to have copied Jung's mode of communication. Like Jung, Peterson often refers to his dreams, presenting them as shamanic-like revelations, and we'll get into shamanism a little bit more in the next episode. And as we'll see, like Jung, Peterson goes to great lengths to interpret the Bible. And as I mentioned, he does a whole lecture series on the Bible. And I remember reading an article recently where he talks about having his plan is to do another whole series of Bible lectures.
Yeah.
In these, he interprets the Bible from a pre-biblical pagan worldview. And that's what I hope you're going to unpack for us in the next episode, Dave, where you're going to be sort of taking the lead and I'll just be riding shotgun.
Yep. The clips are ready to roll.
All right. I think that while Peterson comes across as being sympathetic to Christianity, his underlying teaching undermines Christianity. How many Christians have been caught in Peterson's web? Well, write to us. Let us know what you think.
That's right. You can write to us at info@notconform.show. And by the way, Dan, we got a fantastic email, which we couldn't quite fit into this episode, but I think we'll have to start the next episode with mm-hmm. a great email commenting on a last episode where we started with the whole Jordan Peterson business. So write to us, and there's a good chance if you've got a great email, you might end up on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, you can find us at notconform.show, where you'll find all the episode pages and show notes and subscribe links and embedded players. You can actually, if you wanted to send a buddy just a little clip of this episode, you can actually do that on the webpage. Just send little snippets of the show and post them in your social media or whatever. So again, the website is the best way to spread the word about the show. Just point them to notconformed.show, and for your feedback, info@notconformed.show.
All right, Dave, thanks for all the reads today, and we'll talk to you on the next show.
Sounds great. We'll see you then.